morning. Ready to call our first case today, which is 97-2181, Brown v. Dibble, representing the defendants. Dr. Dibble et al. Is Joy L. Obrowski. Ms. Obrowski.
Justices, members of the court, distinguished counsel, honored guests, may it please the court. I'm Joy Obrowski, here appearing on behalf of the defendants, petitioners, and I'm accompanied by my partner, Mr. Curtis Swanson. The issue before the court that is on petition is the issue of whether or not, in this particular case where a jury has found the patient contributory negligent, and in all informed consent cases, can there be a defense of contributory negligence? And I would like to cut to the quick with the court in that regard. First of all, I'm not going to go back over the long history of informed consent and this court's participation in that history. The court is well aware of it. However, I am impressed that the court has renewed and maintained its commitment to deciding these cases on a negligence theory with a reasonable person standard in the most recent case in Schreiber, written by Justice Bradley. And I would like to capture then the sense that if this court has chosen to decide these cases, that the courts of Wisconsin and the jury of Wisconsin should decide cases on the negligence claim, there was one basic principle that prevails. And it is in the statute on comparative negligence, and it is quoted by this court in the case of Peters versus Menard. And I would like to begin with that statement, for it is the groundwork of the petitioner's argument, and it is what I believe is the controlling law in this state. In that decision written by Justice Babbage, the court writes, "In Wisconsin, every person owes a duty of care to the entire world to refrain from conduct which is foreseeably could cause harm to others. In addition, every person in all situations has a duty to exercise ordinary care for his or her own safety." We, of course, are asking this court to overturn the decision of the Court of Appeals. We are asking that because we believe the Court of Appeals decision is based on, with all due respect, faulty reasoning. And I would like to address, although I'm not going to repeat what I've argued in my brief, I would like to address some of those points. But before that, I would like to speak to this court about a practical matter. And that is just exactly what did the players in this particular case do, which informs us about what the decision in this case, we believe, should be. There was an affirmative defense of contributory negligence from the commencement of this case in the answer. And learned counsel and the plaintiff, who this court has ruled she is responsible under Schneller versus St. Mary's for his actions, never ever addressed that issue.
What issue?
The issue of contributory negligence. There were no motions in limine. There was not a word in the trial brief. There was nothing. Clearly, the judge in this case thought that that was the applicable law in Wisconsin. The defendants did. The jury had no problem with it, or they would have answered it no. I do not believe there were any questions about that issue raised. But most importantly, when we get to the trial of this matter, and I'll refer the court to the record 73, pages 146 and 147, there is a long series of questions on cross-examination whose sole purpose is to establish the conduct of Ms. Brown for purposes of making a contributory negligence claim. There can be no other reason for those questions when the court reviews that. And there is not a single objection to the relevancy of those questions. If plaintiff truly believed that the law of contributory negligence was inapplicable in this case, there should have been objections to relevancy, and in order not to prejudice the jury, there certainly should have been motions in limine prior.
Are you arguing waiver?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's hard for me to argue waiver at this point.
That's exactly
and then because I didn't try this case, but I'm arguing common sense.
Oh.
And when I attended the investiture of Justice Prosser, I heard this court make a commitment to several things: independence, integrity, impartiality, fairness, and common sense.
Is that to be a substitute for the rule of law that if you don't raise waiver until you get to the Supreme Court, you can argue common sense?
No, I'm not asking you to do waiver. I'm asking you to stop and think about whether or not this was an afterthought, and whether or not, when you look at the players in this case, whether or not you can't say everyone believed that this was going to apply, because if you look at the history of negligence law, there is no reason for it not to. And there is no reason for this court to make an exception to that law in this circumstance. And I'd like to go to those points just a little bit now. The Court of Appeals, with all due respect, indicated that patients should be immunized in this particular circumstance because there is a disparity of knowledge. And I have argued in my brief that there are many cases of negligence law where there's a disparity of knowledge, and this court has not made an exception to the rule under those circumstances. The point I'd like to make in that regard here, however, is the very jury instruction itself rectifies that concern. And the instruction given in this case specifically addressed that issue. Taken straight from the standard instruction, the instruction given to the jury here in the second paragraph was, to be free of negligence, a person must exercise ordinary care in choosing his or her course of conduct and in the pursuit of that choice. A person is not guilty of negligence in making a choice of conduct if the person has no knowledge that one course of conduct carries a greater hazard than another, provided such lack of knowledge is not the result of the person's failure to exercise ordinary care. Yes, Justice?
Well, counsel, I have a difficult time understanding how a patient can be contributorily negligent in choosing one of the alternative forms of one of the alternative procedures suggested by his or her doctor. How can a patient be contributory negligent in those circumstances? I'm not talking about affirmative actions on behalf of the plaintiff, such as lying or covering something up or not being completely candid with the doctor. I'm talking solely in terms of assuming that the patient has been totally candid, has done everything in terms that the doctor has asked. How can the patient be contributory negligent with respect to choosing option A, B, or C as suggested by the doctor?
Actually, Justice, it's appropriate that you should raise that question because my answer hinges on your kidney stones. In the recent case argued before this court, Schreiber, the court asked a question that raised an issue for me that I looked up because I anticipated your question. And there you
were. Goosebumps went up the back of my neck when you mentioned the kidney.
what was raised in that discussion, and also Justice Abrahamson had questions related to this, was to address the tradition that has long existed in this state of, even though there may be viable choices, one always has the right to not only choose but to totally refuse. Inherent in that law, and in the questions that were asked in the Schreiber case, is the belief, and I think the correct belief, that while there is a definition in the administrative code of what is medically viable, there is also what is viable to the patient. I may be given all kinds of medical choices that would be medically viable, but they may not be viable for me. And I think the facts of this case is a very good illustration of that. In this particular case, when you get to the evidence, if you have not already, you will see that it is replete with concern by Mrs. Brown about disfigurement. And she is no stranger to surgery. I counted at least 7 in the evidence prior surgeries before this event. So she's aware of disfigurement. So I think what's there in terms of two viable decisions is not only what is viable medically, but what is viable for me, the patient. Because I can choose to get out of the water and ask for surgery. If that's what serves me. Justice Abramson had a question about, well, isn't pain in labor enough? Is it really about a medical situation? Doesn't what the patient wants and what fills the patient's need play into viability every bit as much as the medical consideration?
Well, take my way of hypothetical, extending this. I mean, you seem to be suggesting that, look, she didn't want scarring. She's concerned about appearance. She chose an option that would allow for scarring, and so she's negligent if she isn't happy with the scarring with which she ended up with. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think I'm saying more than that.
Well, tell me.
I think I'm saying that before that point in time, a jury of her peers, could come to the conclusion that when you have an invasive and clearly disfiguring process, a drastic procedure, and the other viable option is one where it is a matter of waiting and trying.
What if I have a tumor on my forehead, and I'm concerned about my appearance? A viable option, medical alternative, is to remove the tumor, but I would have scarring. Another viable option is some kind of injection, and maybe the tumor will reduce. The most probably maximum way of getting rid of the problem is surgery, removing the tumor, which will leave scarring. I choose that viable alternative, knowing that I'm going to have a scar on my face. But lo and behold, after the surgery occurs, not only is the scar that on my face, but it's much larger than anticipated. Don't I have a cause of action for that kind of scarring on my face? I'm not saying I prevail, but don't I have a right to bring a cause of action for that?
I don't think that's the issue.
Okay, let me rephrase that. Don't I have a right to choose that form of treatment without being held to be contributory negligent for that choice?
No, because that was the second point that I was going to get to. We talk about two viable options, but what are they really truly addressing here? If the concern and the need of the patient is reduction of risk of cancer, and the maximum of that, your surgery, this is the best thing that can happen. There is only one option, but that's not her goal. And the second is there's not her sole goal. She's trying to weigh two things, what's viable for her and what's not. So no, I think what it is that you have to say, it sounds wonderful on a superficial level that there are two viable options and you simply choose between them. It's far more complicated than that. But I think what's the crux of this matter is that what we're doing here is saying that's for the jury to decide on the evidence. They're the people who have seen it, watched it, heard the inflections, and the question that's before this court is, should they be able to decide that issue? And when you phrase it in her well-being could be beyond just the health, the ultimate health. It may well be disfigurement. It may well be a number of other things. And hearing all the evidence, the issue before this court is, does the jury, when there is evidence, do they get to decide? And this court has long held its belief that juries should decide those kinds of matters.
I noted at the outset you framed or partially framed the question in the context of when a jury has decided. I think you said something like, whether contributory negligence of a patient is available as a defense in an informed consent action where a jury has found that a plaintiff has not used ordinary care. Why, and I took note of that, what difference does it make whether a jury has determined or addressed the issue? Isn't the question a question of law, and that question being whether contributory negligence of a patient is available as a defense in an informed consent action, whether or not you address that at the time the summons and complaint is filed, or whether or not you address that subsequently in a motion hearing? It seems to me that issue is an issue of law having little regard to what the jury determines.
I think this court has already decided the answer in a long history of negligence cases, all of which have contributory negligence as a defense, has already answered both of those questions. And what I'm calling you to is a recognition of that fact. In response to the second question, the point of that question is, we do entrust things to juries, and they are part of what this law is about. And they found nothing odd about being given this question, apparently, and on the evidence, they found that there was reason to believe that she was contributory negligent. So they weren't appalled by the law, and I don't know, Your Honor, as a trial lawyer, I see juries right in the margin, when they think that we're all slightly crazed, or they don't approve of what we've sent to them. But I think what that message is that a group of her peers, the people that we entrust to decide in this state, did not think that she should not be held to that standard and had no problem in determining that she did for any variety of reasons, one of which could be not only in the end decision, but during the process. I don't know if that answers your question.
Response, witness.
Ms. Ogrosky,
yes.
What was the evidence presented to the jury in regard to negligence concerning informed consent? Negligence on the part of the patient?
I think that could come in many ways, but I anticipated your question, so I'll give you some examples. I'll give you some examples. I'll actually read you from the evidence, and I'm referring to 73-146, starting at that point in time. And I think you'll see how clearly this goes strictly to that issue, because it goes to nothing else in this trial. Did you, back at the time that you saw Dr. Alfuth, her primary provider, and you discussed that you had an increased risk or high risk or somewhat increased risk of breast cancer, did you ask him for any statistics at that time? No. He said slightly high risk. Question. And did you ask Dr. Johnson or Dr. DeBell for statistics when you saw them? Did you make that request? No. Question. Did you at any point make a request of Dr. DeBell or Dr. Johnson to see photographs of people who had undergone breast reconstruction? Answer, I never thought of it. Question, did you ask for an example, brochures that would describe that? Did you ever request that? No. Would you like more, Your Honor? I mean, those are the kinds of questions that I'm referring to that are clearly to the issue of her conduct with respect to contributory negligence in the informed consent process.
Well, doesn't that put the burden then on the patient to be asking all kinds of questions beyond what the doctor has presented to him or her? Why should the patient have to ask about statistics?
I'd like to go back and go way back to Canterbury in response to that. But before I do that, Aaron, I'd like to make clear just exactly what the petitioners are asking for. We are asking for what a jury will decide is the exercise of ordinary care. And it will be a jury question. And they can say, if they choose, a patient shouldn't have to ask for statistics. All right? But I want to go back to Canterbury, and on which this court heavily relied in writing the Scaria decision. Trogan, too, I believe. And if you read the footnotes there, the court goes into a great explanation of how this process will work, and that it's based upon the assumption that a patient, after the discussion, will be able to have at least the level of sophistication to understand what's being said. And there is a statement in those footnotes in which the court says, you know, while they're not expected to generate questions, and I'm paraphrasing this, the essence of this is when they receive information, they should be able to at least be able to sort it out, deliberate about it, and ask for clarification or other information if necessary. And the important thing is, in Canterbury and in Scaria, this court recognized in adopting the reasonable person's needs standard that a doctor could not be a clairvoyant. Now, we're not asking for medical terminology. We're asking, as you'll see, if the court was given the little diagram that I used to try to show the court the process, we're asking for simple clarification of the patient's needs. Because no court, other than those that have adopted a subjective standard, have expected physicians to be able to do that. So, for example, Your Honor, I firmly believe that people learn not only auditorily but visually. Therefore, I put together this little diagram. And what's wrong with saying?
Opposing counsel, have your diagram. There's a diagram right on.
You
do.
Yes.
Is there any objection to this, counsel?
No.
Okay. You may proceed.
Is there something wrong with saying to your doctor? And if you look at the Court of Appeals decision, they cite Kelly, a 1950 case about a drugless, unlicensed healer, not even a physician, for the proposition this must be a trusting relationship. If you have a trusting relationship, what is wrong with expecting that you say to your doctor, Dr. DeBell, you know, I catch these things a lot better if you draw me a picture. You know, I noticed there were brochures out there. I didn't see one on this. Is there any way that you can help me? And that is all the defense is asking for.
Well, but, counsel,
but the question is,
counsel, sorry. How are we going to tell all the patients in this state that that's what's expected of them?
You aren't going to tell
them. I know that you can ask the same question. How are all the doctors in the state going to know about this? But the doctors have continuing medical education. They are members of organizations and get literature, and they can be advised. So how do you expect a patient, other than people on the bench and maybe lawyers, to know that they are expected to ask for a diagram?
I don't think that's the issue before this court. I believe the issue before this court is what a jury is allowed to decide. And it's no different. How do you tell consumers in a products liability case what they're supposed to know? How do you tell people who drive on highways what they're supposed to know? Maybe what happens after this is done is that a jury instruction is developed, which is how most people learn that as passengers, they have an obligation to advise a driver once they're in litigation. There is a great deal of law that people are bound by in this state that they do not have the specifics of. But if you have developed a process, and if there is this true trusting relationship that we hear in the commentaries, in the case law, it should be an open part of it. And part of it will be encouraged by physicians. I'm not ever here to advocate this is an equal slate. But I am here to advocate that it should be a fair playing field.
What kind of law, then, do we give in this jury instruction? I mean, you're advocating let the jury decide, but they have to have contours and framework within which to decide. What is your rule of law within which they should decide that would mandate, in this case, a plaintiff to ask for a brochure or a picture?
1007. Which is contributory negligence.
Now, I'm talking about more than the 1007. What's the rule of law?
Your Honor, there's no rule of law for any other situation of 1007.
Well, you have 1007, contributory negligence. Let's take an ordinary auto accident case. Then you have a separate instruction on failure to yield right away, a separate instruction on what unreasonable speed means, a separate instruction on traveling too fast for conditions. What's the separate instruction on the duty of the patient to ask for a brochure or a photograph? We need more than 1007. What's the law? What's the direction that we
have? I think you could do things. I don't think it's ever stopped any court to develop law just because it was going to have to develop an instruction. But it developed an instruction about what physicians should do, and that was a process. What's wrong with saying you should make an attempt to the best of your ability to give your physician accurate information that is complete? Second of all, if you do not understand, you should indicate to your physician that you do not understand. Every jury instruction is simple examples of what is applicable.
Counsel, as one looks around, and I think that we've had two cases, basically. This is a case of first impression here. You have a case in Hawaii which rejected this proposition. We had a case in New York which I think is a little unclear. So what you're asking this court to do is something, obviously, which we rely on precedent. We look around. Do you have any, and from a public policy standpoint, what real effect will this have on the
440.30, you know, the informed consent. This was asked in other ways here, but I have some concern about that.
I think that is a good question, Your Honor. And I think for a long time, courts have hidden behind the belief that what they decide in this process has no effect on the medical experience of patients. I think the message will be to encourage, as a public policy, a true partnership and a participation by all of the members, not on an equal basis, but to their capacity. I think that this court is able to meet that challenge and to set precedents. It has, in a number of recent cases, addressed issues of first impression. I want to close with asking yourself, if you make this exception, what kind of mess is developed out there, and how do you justify that to other litigants who, in just as complicated of situations, have been held to be contributory negligent or will be held to be? And I think that's something this court has to, when it's talking about the challenge of doing this, it needs to think about the challenge of not doing it as well. My time is up, and I thank the court for this honor.
Thank you, and you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel?
May it please the court, I'm Attorney Tom Gilzo. I'm joined with Mike Loffenberg to represent Mrs. Brown and her husband in this matter.
You have our permission to move the glass of water if you want before it spills.
And I'm supposed to put the podium up too. My argument apparently won't be lofty or elevated this morning. I tried this case. Great defense lawyer Steve Collum tried this case out of Trempealeau County. We took it to the appeal to the 3rd District, and now I stand before you. I recognize some of you wonder if I ever try any case that doesn't end up on appeal, and may you know that I'm wondering that myself, and particularly in the last 2 years. The PowerPoint that I think is different about this case is it raises a great issue for our court. And it's one that, when simply stated, when a doctor does give viable choices, and we as patients select one of those choices, how can we be negligent? You know, fundamental to all of this does require us to go back, even though this court has recently been there in January in the Shriver case, and think about the basis for 448.30 and 1973, when we started in this state with informed consent and the recognition thereof, ultimately codified into our law. Bottom line is that we as patients don't have the knowledge that we need to make decisions concerning our care.
Are you saying, counsel, that in no case can the plaintiff be found contributory negligent? And I, of course, am thinking of the example of what if I, as a patient, deliberately withhold very relevant information from my treating doctor?
I am not.
Beg pardon?
I am not saying that. Nor is Waddell's brief saying that. Nor is the fund saying that. I follow what I think our 3rd District Court has said, that with the exception, and I quote, with extraordinary circumstances, there is not comparative negligence in informed consent.
What about failing to, if I as a patient fail to divulge all the information that the doctor can make a decision on, I mean, assuming it's relevant,
sure,
or that I give misleading or false information?
I think that goes to the heart of every suit, and many we have been tried in this state already. The reasonableness then of the instruction. Remember, in this case, there is no question, although counsel has referred to the alleged misrepresentations on the mother's cancer. In this case, it's irrelevant. Why? We admit the choices were viable. If that would have had any bearing, that would have had to do with whether to go or not to go. But I agree with you to say that I think it's clearly relevant. But when you read the jury instruction on whether the...
Standing for the microphone.
Thank you.
Sorry.
When you read the jury instruction 1023 on the duty of informed consent, certainly if someone has entered into a dialogue with a patient, the patient has lied to them, misrepresented facts, the reasonableness is there, and that's certainly relevant and is going to come before the jury to be taken into account.
Does it come in on the doctor's negligence or the patient's? Are you saying that failing to tell the full truth is not a contributory negligence issue?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear last.
What I'm trying to ask you is, where does misrepresentation by the patient or omission by the patient come in the equation?
I think right under 1023, the reasonableness of what he said, if this patient has lied to me and you have given me a state of facts and I believe those to be true and I told you to have a certain operation that didn't ultimately would have been recognized or recommended had I had the true facts, it would have been before the jury on that basis to say, based upon the facts you had, you made your decision, doctor. That's correct. Had she given you the real facts, would you have recommended the same? No, I would not have.
So that's why your response is that ordinarily there's no contributory negligence. You don't get it in under contributory negligence. You get it in under the original issue.
Justice Abramson, I cannot hear you. I'm sorry.
Is my microphone not on? I know that the marshal is checking that, but I'll try again. In other words, you don't think that in most cases, or to put it another way, it's your position that, except in unusual circumstances, there is no contributory negligence in an informed consent case.
That is correct.
And that failure to state the full truth or misrepresenting the facts does not constitute contributory negligence. It goes to evaluating the doctor's decision or the doctor's conduct. That's your position?
Well, I think it comes in weighed in light, as I said, of 1023 to say if it's certainly not unreasonable for a doctor to recommend procedure A if a patient lied and that's the basis in which he'd lie to. The finding of the jury is then he did not fail to give proper consent.
So what you're saying, just so I understand, there would be no circumstance. In other words, if...
I think that everybody's having some trouble hearing all of us. So I did move my microphone closer to me, and I think we're just going to have to do it. Pardon me? The speakers are not working, and therefore that explains the difficulty. So we'll just have to raise our voices and try and do better. So I apologize.
Okay. I was
Justice
only going to...
Speak up.
Just to follow how far you would go, if the information provided by the patient is inaccurate, but the doctor gives a series of possibilities, you could do this, you could do that, you're saying under no circumstance would this be considered a contributory negligent act.
Now, as you have stated it, I would not say that's true.
Okay.
Because I think if the claim is based, if you will, on fraud, that would fall in with what the Third District is talking about in extraordinary cases. So then you could talk about comparative or contributory negligence.
Counsel, I'm having a problem because it seems like it's not falling into line. You just talked about fraud, but fraud isn't contributory negligence. The Court of Appeals says in extraordinary cases there can be contributory negligence. In response to the Chief's comment, you seem to suggest that giving misleading or false information or failing to give information comes under 1023, informed consent, and how you evaluate the doctor's compliance with 1023. And it seems to be, and at least in my mind, not coming together. Let me ask, number one, do you agree with the Court of Appeals opinion that there can be contributory negligence in extraordinary circumstances?
I do.
Number two, what constitutes those extraordinary circumstances?
The first ones that come are those that raised by Justice Babbage earlier. That if someone failed to follow through with care, Didn't go to the New York case, whatever else, so okay. You're talking, you failed to mitigate damages. Those are those in the realm of the extraordinary.
Okay, other, now that deals with, as I said, that New York case that was cited. After the fact, after the informed consent discussion, and what was said in informed consent, after the surgery, you fail to follow post-op with the care, and you can be contributory negligent. With any other example, other than failing to follow the suggested or required treatment program of the doctor after surgery, is there any other extraordinary circumstance where the plaintiff can be contributory negligent in an informed consent case?
Generally, no. And when you push me, as I know you're trying to say, I tried even in my brief to give some examples that hit me viscerally or cerebrally,
well,
as to what they would be. And I talked
What about Justice Babbage's example is followed by the chief, essentially. What about misrepresentation? What about lying? What about intentional omission? Are those acts of negligence that are attributed to the plaintiff and can constitute contributory negligence of the plaintiff in informed consent?
They possibly would be. And they could be construed under the extraordinary circumstances that I can see myself in front of most trial judges, those same arguments being made and said, all right, we have a lying plaintiff, Your Honor. Where are we going to put that? Well, that's just generally is construed as negligence. Well, isn't that what the Third District meant then? We're going to have a question because now we've got somebody who lied to their doctor. It could go there. I can see them also saying, Your Honor, I think I'm entitled to a kick at the cat under 1023 because it isn't reasonable then that he's giving them informed consent if they have a plaintiff that's lying.
So one of the reasons I'm confused is that you're putting it both places. You're putting it under contributory negligence. I'm talking about the misleading or false information or omission. You're putting it under both contributory negligence and you're putting it under the doctor's responsibility under 1023. Which is the better route to put? Take.
Which is better?
Yes.
Negligence. Under those circumstances. Because I think what you run into is almost the inviolate concept of informed consent and the statute that says, doctor, it is solely yours, and that if we start to erode at that, then we have this amorphous concept of what must a patient do. And that's a scary thing, because for juries, like in this case, after we went ahead and had our expert give 12 things that the doctor had failed to inform Ms. Brown, then when you go and ask those people, well, couldn't you have done that? Or if you will, if we would have the Cocamore case back in front of us, and if we'd have the, and ask Mr. Cocamore today, why didn't you ask whether this doctor's experience was greater? Why didn't you ask if there was a CT scan in the hospital? Why didn't you ask if there was a neurosurgeon? All of that is profoundly reasonable to a jury that's looking by hindsight after the fact the damage is done and saying, I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
Well, counsel, let's assume that the patient has not asked the doctor about what the most recent or what articles in the New England Journal of Medicine have said about it. And the patient says, the plaintiff says, I never asked the doctor that. And so then the defendant tries to get that as part of contributory negligence. I'm creating a very facetious, because I think you and I would both agree that there's no way that that would be contributorily negligent. But why isn't a jury perfectly capable of deciding that also? And when you argue that as the plaintiff's lawyer, the jury goes in to deliberate and says, okay, now on this question of contributory negligence, I don't think there's any duty on the part of the patient to ask about what articles appeared in the New England Family Journal of Medicine. In other words, aren't these the kind of decisions that we always just place in the hands of the jury and hope, and I think they usually do, come up with very reasonable responses? Yeah, that's contributory negligent, or yeah, that's not.
I think the problem that you feel when you're there and you watch this testimony come in is the jury has nothing to guide them. and it's touched on earlier by Justice Plus Bradley, that says we have no jury instruction. They have no common experience of what people do when they are misinformed by their doctors. And so they're left saying, unlike a slip and fall in their life experience that can guide them, unlike the traffic rules in this state, unlike even product liability 3200 instruction, we tell them specifically what it means to have an unreasonable and defective product. They have guidelines to guide them. Here, they can hear a expert for the plaintiff say the doctor should have done thus and so, and just like counsel has read, then you get into this litany of why couldn't you have asked? Why didn't you ask if there was a CT scan in this hospital while your wife was suffering? Why didn't you ask for statistics? And to say, now that they heard it's 1 out of 25 chances of getting cancer in 20 years of your life, anyone I submit reasonably is going to say, well, why didn't that, wasn't that asked before? Without understanding, the job was the doctor that put her in the high-risk category. Quote, it is highly probable you will get cancer and, like your sister, die. And this operation can prevent that, and cosmetically, you look better after than before. And saying, when you look at the duty of the doctor to tell her of all risk, and she has the right to choose, even with Schreiber, during labor, do we really want to open this up after we've heard the evidence and just simply tell juries, why couldn't someone have asked? I think of the Kokomores, the plaintiffs in the Kokomore case, how many times they must have asked themselves, why didn't they ask the question if the doctor had any experience? Was there a CAT scan in this hospital? And all of the other cases that were factually based in our past, that have led from 73, the road right to this courthouse today, where none of those questions were ever asked of plaintiffs. It was simply just what is the duty of the doctor to tell them.
But removing myself as a lawyer, as a judge, and just thinking of myself as a juror, I can think, if some questions weren't asked, I might say, yeah, you should have asked that. A reasonable person would have asked that. And so I take that into account in determining contributory negligence. And then there are other questions that I would say, no, a reasonable person wouldn't think to answer that. But that's the task that we routinely give to juries in very difficult cases.
Steve, I want to emphasize the difficulty that I see is that's all by hindsight. And that is like looking at all facts backwards of what would we have done differently if we knew it, if we knew the results of what we would do. What would we do differently if we knew the election results? What would we do differently? And then you ask the jurors, now that you know all those facts, you think you might have asked it. And when someone already heard all those complaints and has seen all the results and looked at the results of surgery and the scarring, then they say, maybe she should have asked another question. And the saying, the duty solely placed by the legislature is to say, doctor, you have an obligation to tell that patient. And that patient has the right to accept or refuse. And the sadness in this case is when the doctor didn't give Marlene Brown informed consent, he usurped her right to say no.
Could I ask, is the failure of a patient to ask a question ever contributory negligence?
Well, knowing I'm not omniscient, and there may be some fact and circumstances that's going to change our feelings in the future, in the main, to write a rule of law, no. I think we will be, after this, trying all the lawsuits by first saying, doctor, what did you do wrong? And the doctor saying, then the patient has some obligation to cure my wrongs. They should ask me more questions. They should have done that. And I think it would be a horrifying result to place that burden on our people in the state to say, before you go in for surgery, this is the whole list of questions in which you should follow. You should make the calls. And can you hear the cross-examinations? Appropriately so, but good defense lawyers. Did you look at the internet? Did you see anything on the internet? No, I didn't. Well, do you have the computer in your home? Why wouldn't you look this up if it was a life and death circumstance as you thought it was? Did you go to the library? Did you get the New England Journal of Medicine? After a while, you know, not even the most Einsteinian lawyer is going to think of questions that a jury is going to say, ah, you know, it kind of makes sense. Why didn't they even go down to the local library and look up breast? There's got to be some point where we said, you know, there's something about that that just doesn't get into this lukewarm feeling that we call ordinary negligence.
But if a jury of 12 people concludes that that's what a reasonable person should have done, where are we to argue?
After the problem I see is after the fact and without a rule of law to guide them. That if the doctor, your duty is to tell me in this fashion, let me try it metaphorically, hope this works. I'll fly you to Eau Claire. We can go two ways. Here's your option, both viable. I'll drive you up there, it'll take me 2.5 to 3 hours. Or I can fly you there in 50 minutes. Which way would you like to go? So I'd rather fly, so that's fine. Let me tell you about my airplane. I haven't had it annual for quite a while. I don't have my VFR, my IFR isn't current. And the radio doesn't work, and they've got thunderstorms forecast for the day when I go back.
Ah, let's go. Let's be risky.
Yeah. But I didn't tell you that. I gave you two viable options. And then when I crash, your estate says, why didn't he ask these questions? Why didn't he ask about her instruments? Why didn't he? Why, what about my GPS? Is my radar on there? Am I de-iced? When was I last IFR? Say, wait a minute, you're talking Greek to me. Unfortunately, oftentimes, so do doctors, so do lawyers.
Well, in your example, might a jury conclude it would be very reasonable for me to ask you whether or not you've had any experience flying in tough weather?
If, in the where the fallacy of my argument is, you've recognized they have common life experience to guide them. They don't have common life experience to guide them in that doctor relationship. You know, it's amazing. That's kind of, we're turning it upside down. We're saying first you need informed consent for the patient even to know, but then by some kind of osmosis, I guess, the jury's supposed to have this in their common life experience, and yet 448.30 says they can't. That was the whole reason we gave them informed consent. So how do we get the transfusion of that knowledge that the patient, plaintiff doesn't have, into the veins of the jury and pretend they got it for purposes of the verdict?
I'd like to go back to your question. I did recently fly to Eau Claire.
I'm sorry.
I said I did recently fly to Eau Claire, and I did recently charter a plane. And I make certain assumptions when a professional is given to me, or I hired. I make assumptions that the guy's got a license. I make assumptions that it's raining and that he's equipped to fly in rainy weather, and that there's a chance of ice coming, all of which was checked out in the weather. But I make assumptions about that plane, that it's been de-iced. I make assumptions that he's equipped. I make assumptions that it's cloudy weather and he is an IFR rather than VFR, and I know about the two, having represented people that deal with planes. So I make all these assumptions, and I did not cross-examine the pilot about all of this. And so the question is, should I? And then should I have an obligation when I go to a professional, I go to an expert, I go to an oncologist, raise all these questions? And what's your answer, counsel?
My answer is, that's the purpose 448.30, that when a doctor, or when the pilot, if you will, is certified commercially to fly you, you have the right to trust. He has the knowledge, he has the experience, he knows what he's doing, he's licensed, or she is licensed to practice medicine, knows the rules, and when they say, now, based upon what I'm telling you, let's fly to Eau Claire, and you say, all right, Gilzo, I'll go with you. Because you know I'm certified, you know I'm commercially rated, or I want to remove your kidney, and I tell you why it's good, or the breast, and saying, this is a viable way to do it. Here are your risks. You trust me. That's the nature, the second ingredient of informed consent. One, the lack of knowledge. Two, trust.
Now, of course, it's better practice for the patient to ask these questions. In fact, there was a newspaper article just this week that indicated that the less experience a physician or a hospital has in various surgeries, the greater the risk for the patient. So it is better practice for the patient to ask it. You just don't want to make it a rule of law.
I think what that falls into, in my view, is the reasonableness of this exchange in the dialogue. What I don't want to do is to write negligence in reverse and impose a burden upon the public that has never been imposed there before. Let's be sure that I haven't been caught here in some colloquy, because I think this point is extremely important. What I am suggesting is, yes, if there's a dialogue, as the diagram would show, if that is how they take their road to their decision, it doesn't matter how many right or left turns they take, but they come to this decision where the only thing that's important is the decision that the patient makes. That's what's important in informed consent. And so, is it appropriate to ask the questions? Yes. Would that come in under the reasonableness of 1023? Yes. I have not addressed, by the way, the jury instruction. I'll wait for my 5 minutes to close.
Chief?
Right. You both argued on both the petition and cross-petition.
I'm sorry?
You both have argued on the petition and cross-petition here. Okay.
May I ask one question? I understand a failure to inform, but I thought there was one point where you said that the doctor had misinformed.
It's true. It's both. In some ways, as I see it, this is even an inducement for surgery. Because when the patient is there and being told, you will even look better afterwards, I can make you better after this surgery than you will before, that I can prevent cancer, I see that as not only an uninformed, misinformed, but an inducement, all of which, by our law, says is a violation of informed consent.
Justice Babbage has a question.
I'm sorry?
Justice Babbage has a question, counsel.
Okay. The Chief's question prompted this, counsel. What if I, as a plaintiff, I am a plaintiff, but I have a specialized knowledge, I have a special knowledge in the area of which we're talking, for whatever reason, and yet I do not pursue that with the doctor. Under our normal, the Chief's example, certainly if you've got a specialized knowledge, the law of contributory negligence is that the jury can take that into account. It's the reasonable person in the shoes of the plaintiff. Now, are you saying that if I have a specialized knowledge and yet I fail to ask a common sense question of the doctor, that I still shouldn't be held contributorily negligent? Or would that be unusual circumstance?
I think it's unusual circumstance.
Oh, okay.
Am I cut? You want me to respond?
If you have, I heard you responding in unusual circumstances,
okay.
So that if you satisfied
with
me. Yeah. Okay, thank you, counsel.
I think I saw the answer as I was asking it.
And you do have 5 minutes.
Excuse me.
Oh. Thank you. I'd like to address these points in some kind of order, but first of all, I would like to propose that one of the problems and one of the reasons I gave the diagram is the Court of Appeals acted like the only time anything mattered in informed consent was the indecision. And I would like to propose this to the court. If the patient cannot be negligent in accepting or choosing two viable options, how can the physician be negligent in offering them? And I give that to you to ponder. The second
how can
is...
The what? I missed that.
How can, if the patient cannot be negligent for choosing two viable options, how can the physician be negligent for offering them? And I'm going to get into the specifics of this case, but I want to leave you with a couple other questions. And that is, why is it too burdensome to ask patients when they are making some life and death decisions in some aspects to exercise ordinary care? And the plaintiff has argued that there is no common experience for a jury. And I would answer to that I believe that's probably one of the more common experiences. And I would argue that I believe a whole lot more jurors have gone to their doctor than in car accidents or flown in planes. But I want to get to a point raised by the Chief Justice's question about flying, and I would advise you not to drive with Mr. Gozo either, because he gets to Eau Claire in 2.5 hours, he speeds. I want to make this point because we're fixated on questions. And what I'm talking about is a dialogue, a discussion, and exchange. So I propose to Justice Abramson that her set of facts. And I add to it, which I think was the point of the Canterbury Court, that the pilot turns around and says, you know, I want to tell you how risky it is to fly today. Got bad weather, got some ice coming on the wings. We'll get there 50 minutes instead of 3.5 hours if you go the speed limit. But, and then the question becomes, does she have an obligation to say, well, can you handle that? Or have you ever flown in this kind of weather before? Not fancy questions, not complicated questions, but at least to engage in an interchange so that she flies satisfied. With that in mind, I'm going to leave that because, pardon me?
We have a case where the doctor gave statistics and they were not right, and we held that that was improper.
I read that case.
Good.
However, you asked, the court also asked Justice Bradley, ask, can you think of any other situations besides lying? What if the patient is given a list of risks, tells her doctor that she's read them and has not, and then consents? I can think of a number of situations, but I want to go to this case.
Because let me just say, the reason I raised that case with you is, maybe it's the obligation of the pilot to say to me, look, I'm licensed, but, you know, I've never flown in this kind of weather before. Maybe it's the doctor's obligation to say to the patient, I'm a surgeon, and I've done a lot of breast cancer mastectomies, but I've never done one where there have been implants. Now, I think I can handle it, but I think you ought to know that.
I don't have a problem with that, General, but what I'm saying is, that's for a jury to decide what the next process ought to be. And maybe a jury could say, you don't have to ask a fancy question, or you don't have to ask statistics, but maybe what you have to do is say, you know, you told me that I had a high risk here. You know, I think better about those things in numbers. Would you mind giving, can you give me a number to that? Because this is not an argument that there was no information given to this patient, and I'd like to get to that point.
But counsel, what I'm trying to say to you is, why would we put the burden on the patient to ask? Isn't the burden on the doctor to say?
Yes, the burden on the doctor to say, but this is not a one-sided event, Your Honor.
Well,
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's the question. You keep saying it's not one-sided, and that's really the question. The question is, how one-sided should it be? And that is, it did an obligation of the doctor to say, I'm experienced in breast surgery, not with implants. Or, I don't have experience in liver transplants. I have experience in other transplants. And then it's not for the patient to say, how many liver transplants have you done?
I don't disagree with the fact that the physician must tell something. Then I think it becomes a jury question as to whether or not the patient has any obligation in response to that. And that's my point.
That's fair.
My time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, would you address your jury instruction?
I would. Stated quite simply, I think the 1023-2 is a misstatement of 448-30. And the difficulty with it, as you will see from the brief, is essentially the jury instruction would permit the jury to determine at any time, under any circumstances, they find an excuse or reason for a doctor not to inform that they shall have an exception. And as Waddell's brief by Jim Wise has said, and I think he spoke it very simply, is that means, I suppose, if the jury thinks that he was having a bad day, going through a divorce, whatever it might be, was reason for these circumstances, they can, they, the jury, can determine without a rule of law, without any guidance, what it ought to be. And that's contrary to 448.30, which gives us six exceptions. And at the tail end of his brief, you'll see it's so simple as far as how we would function in our state by adopting that jury instruction that Jim Wise has placed. And that is, if he falls with any of these six statutory factors, then you can find that he or she, the doctor, has not met has to meet their duty of informed consent. I don't think it goes greater than that in many ways, people, because the difficulty I hear, the thread running through both of these issues is we keep saying, let the jury do what the jury would want to do. And I mean, that is it. Let me pause for a minute on this point. It's a frightening concept, tempting though it is. But we give juries lots of jury instructions before we go out there. We don't take 12 people in the community and say, let's be fair. You figure out what's fair out there. What's right under these circumstances. You heard everybody. You know these folks. They're from your community. Just apply your good sense to this. We give them a ton of jury instructions, spend 45 minutes to an hour and a half reading those from the bench. They have guides by which to process their information, and we tell them they're to follow that law. And I look for the law in saying, what would we tell these folks? Where do we find reasonable folks who are misinformed in surgery? How can they get this information that we depend that doctors to impart to patients?
Well, let me ask that question of you. How do you define, then, the duty of patient's duty of reasonable care in the informed consent context? How do you define that duty?
I think when I look at 1007, sub 4, the fourth footnote on the appellate brief, I think it's page 7 of their brief in the third district, conceptually what they're saying is we have a duty to exercise reasonable care unless we don't have the knowledge by which to make informed choices. Now, it wouldn't take a lot of intellectual scholarship to change that to talk about that people do not possess this knowledge. Essentially, it is the rationale that undergirds every one of our informed consent cases.
Can you try that again? How do you define